Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 24, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got two guests scheduled for tonight. First, in about 8 minutes or so, we'll be speaking with Michael Hart, who is a professor of literature at Duke University and co-author of the international mega-hit bestseller Empire, along with Tony Negri. I wanted to have him on a few weeks ago during the fundraising special I did on the State of the Empire, but he wasn't around. He was vacationing, and so he's back, and wanted to have the interview with him that never was a few weeks ago. And then at the bottom of the hour, slightly after, we'll speak with Julie Abraham, who is a professor of LGBT studies at Sarah Lawrence College. This is the Stonewall segment of the program. The Stonewall weekend coming up, Gay Pride weekend coming up, and Sunday going into Monday will be the 35th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, not too far from here, that began the modern gay liberation movement. So in commemoration of that, we'll talk to Julie Abraham about the strange turn that that movement has taken lately in advocating for marriage and what that means. A movement that once started challenged all the norms of bourgeois society now seems to be embracing at least that one. And so she is not too fond of that, so we'll hear her opinion on why not. But before we get to Michael Hart, a few words about the economic headlines, economic releases of the last several days. First of all, durable goods orders in the United States, that is, orders for items that are designed to last 3 years or more, and usually a very sensitive indicator of the state of the business cycle. That was down, it was reported this morning, and the most interesting number in the series is the so-called non-defense capital goods, that is, machinery and equipment and such, ordered by businesses outside of the military sector, and also not including aircraft, which are often very volatile. But the underlying measure of what businesses are spending on investment goods, that is, machines, drill presses, computers, that sort of thing, and also extremely important to a healthy economic expansion and the long-term economic growth of the U.S., and that, it was reported this morning, was down for the second consecutive month, so we've now have two consecutive months of decline in non-defense capital goods orders, a total of 5% decline over the last couple of months, so that it's a volatile series, and it does bounce around all over the place, but a 5% decline over the course of 2 months is not what we should be seeing at this state of the business cycle. So this expansion, recovery, or whatever it is that we've been going through for the last couple of years is still not exactly a mighty and powerful thing as it should be, as most economic expansions have been in modern American history. So it continues to behave very strangely. But one area that is very, very strong, it was reported also this morning that new single-family houses sold rose in May to a record of almost 1.4 million units, a gain of 15% from April. And it does seem that the housing market does continue to be very, very strong. Some people say, including me, that it looks a bit like a bubble. But Alan Greenspan says not. And, of course, who are we to second-guess Alan Greenspan? It was also reported this morning that first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that is, claims filed by people who've just lost their jobs and headed over to the unemployment insurance office, very sensitive indicator of the state of the job market, that was up by 13,000. After a 15,000 decline the previous week, and so it's after falling through much of late last year and early this, it's now stabilized over the last several months. So while the job market does seem to be improving, it is not accelerating. So we've seen several months of solid job growth, but at least on the basis of this indicator, we're not likely to see an acceleration in job growth. So I think we're likely to see gains in the order of a couple of hundred thousand a month, which is good, especially compared to what we saw for the last couple of years, but not really enough to pull down the unemployment rate significantly, and not enough to bring back the tight job markets of the late 1990s, which helped produce rising wages and falling poverty rates. This time we're not seeing that. We're seeing stagnant wages, and I suspect stagnant or even slightly rising poverty rates. One brighter bit of news, the ABC Money Magazine weekly survey of consumers showed a pretty sharp increase for last week after several weeks of decline. And it erased much of the decline we saw in May and early June, erased about half of that. So it did look like high gasoline prices and the war in Iraq and political discontent had been weighing down consumer attitudes, but as at least by this measure, as of last week, people are feeling a bit more optimistic. And also, a couple of items from foreign labor markets. It was reported that Mexico's labor market showed some improvement in May. The Mexican unemployment rate fell from 3.9% in March to 3.6% in April and 3.5% in May. Stronger exports, which means they're certainly benefiting from improved economic tone in the United States. These are helping to boost manufacturing activity, which is translating to job creation, although that translation has been also slow to get going. And in Brazil, the Brazilian unemployment rate also fell from 13.1% in April to 12.2% in May. And as you can see, that's a pretty high number. And by the way, that Mexican number of 3.6 is a very selective figure. Most unemployment figures for poorer countries like Mexico or Brazil should be taken with a grain of salt because they don't cover people who are outside formal labor markets, the people who are selling pencils on the street or poking around trash heaps looking for food and furniture. They don't figure in the official employment statistics. So while you can take them as a measure of the direction of improvement or worsening, and in both cases, Brazil and Mexico, we're seeing a modest improvement, it's still the level of those numbers should be taken with many, many grains of salt. And we'll be back in a moment with Michael Hart, but let's take this musical break and listen to the Butchies, who will be our source of music throughout this program.
Mark our words, we will see you in the future. Kiss your fashion goodbye.
We're born, we're young, we go young, young.
We are
rock, rock.
And that was the Butchies, their song More Rock, More Talk, as a protest song. And what appropriate bit of music introduced Michael Hart, who now joins us from Seattle, where he's spending the summer. Michael Hart, professor of literature at Duke University and co-author with Tony Negri of the international mega-hit bestseller Empire. Welcome to WBAI, Michael.
Hi, Doug. It's glad to be back. I'm glad to be back.
It's good to have you. And like I said in the intro, you didn't hear this, but the audience did, that I wanted to have you on a couple of weeks ago during the fundraising special on the State of the Empire, but you were on vacation, and so unable to do that. But I did want to get your thoughts on the State of the Empire now. After more than a year of the end of the Iraq War, the unilateral fantasies of George Bush seem to have crashed into some boulders. What's your thinking right now? Have the limits of American unilateralism been demonstrated to you?
Yeah, that's the way I would tend to see it. That the let's say the notions that they can recreate an old fashioned imperialism in the dreams of Rumsfeld or Wolfowitz or maybe even Bush himself, I don't know, seem to be proving illusory for them. Yeah, like you say, that that their unilateralist ambitions seem to be crashing down. And that seems to me one of the lessons of reading of the war, and I guess one would hope, even a lesson for those in the U.S. government, that this attempt at a unilateralist U.S. control of the entire globe is something vain and illusory.
Yeah, now particularly traditional O-line leftists took you and Tony Negri to task for arguing an empire that the concept of imperialism today was a much more diffuse and less U.S.-centered thing than they were comfortable with arguing. They thought that really the U.S. ran the world and that you were obscuring that fact by writing Empire. How do you feel now about that kind of criticism?
Well, I remember about a year ago, or a little more than a year ago, I didn't hear myself, but I heard of a friend of both of ours, Tariq Ali, who gave a talk about the war. It was right after really Bush had declared it won and over on the aircraft carrier, and Tariq had joked that Bush and company had read our book Empire, and that he had made this war on Iraq in order to prove us wrong, to show that imperialism's alive and well. Everything is the way it should be. And so I would think a year later, you know, the war certainly hasn't gone very well for them, and those attempts at imperialism haven't gone very well. I would think that by the same logic that if Tariq were to give the same talk today, he would have to say that the failures of the Bush administration, the war would have to prove us right. In other words, that the U.S. unilaterally can't manage an imperialist project like that and would have to seek some other sort of much broader form of global control. I guess that's the way. I mean, that seems indicative of. I guess there were many views, like you were saying, right after the first blush of victory of the U.S. in Iraq, that thought, in fact, that the U.S. was, if not all powerful, able to maintain an imperialist control of the globe on the basis of U.S. national sovereignty as a nation state. And it does seem to me, like you're suggesting, I think, that from today's view, a year later, it doesn't look like that.
Now, what about, it looks like John Kerry wants to at least go back to a more collegial, multilateral view of empire. Is that your reading of his thinking?
I guess so. I would think also that the Bush administration, especially if they were to win the next election, would have to also seek some sort of multilateral arrangements. And that's the reading I understand. As much as I can understand what Kerry's saying about foreign policy, it sounds something a little bit more like Clinton's foreign policy. But like I say, I assume that Bush or any other subsequent Republican president too is going to be forced into some version of that thinking, some sort of collaboration among the dominant nation states rather than a dictation of the U.S. to the others.
And some people from the soft left to the hard left also have been looking to the EU as some kind of counterbalance to U.S. power, and even encouraging some kind of imperial rivalry, inter-imperial rivalry between the U.S. and the EU. What do you make of that sort of talk?
Well, I think that the I think that the notion of democratic regional developments as a kind of stepping stone towards changing the global system is an interesting way of thinking. I'm not sure if only Europe is the way to think of it. And also the notion of an inter-imperialist, putting it in the old mode of an inter-imperialist rivalry also doesn't sound very encouraging for all of us. I mean, the last thing we want is a new Eurocentrism. It's not like we want to go back to the good old days of that. I would rather, thinking in this regional context, it's true that there are many democratic developments within Europe, many possibilities, let's say, even at the constitutional level, a political constitution of Europe. But I would rather look, for instance, to regional alliances like in the southern cone of Latin America between Brazil and Argentina. That might be that might be the kind of regional power bloc that could prove an ally to forces trying to change the global system to at least harness the activities of the World Bank and the IMF to change the balance within WTO talks and that sort of thing. So I wouldn't only place the hopes on Europe. I would also even think about East Asia, about developments in China. That there's another regional possibility of a let's say democratic developments that could change the global balance in these various arenas.
Speaking with Michael Hart, professor of literature at Duke and co-author along with Antonio Negri of Empire, published by Harvard University Press a few years ago. And you mentioned forces trying to change, which brings me to the next question. A little over a year ago, we had a mighty international anti-war movement. A few years ago, we had what was then called the anti-globalization movement, the global justice movement, which was sort of partly synonymous, partly continuous with the anti-war movement. Now where are we? Where are these movements? They seem to have at least disappeared from the headlines. Are they just regrouping, or has something really changed in the structure of opposition?
I don't think – it's always very difficult to read. You know, anyone who makes predictions about movements like this is always, I think, quickly proven wrong, especially if one looks into short-term a view. I think you're right that it's important to read the anti-war movement in a kind of continuity with the previous globalization movements. I mean, I think it's true in large part, you know, from what I know about especially Europe and North America, that a lot of the organizational structures were reutilized in the anti-war movements. And then also even the ideology and the political desires, I think, were quite continuous between the two. What we have now, I mean, with the I wouldn't say there hasn't really been a collapse of the anti-war movements. It's more been a kind of fading, let's say, of the anti-war movements. I would assume, and what I guess I'm most hopeful for, is not exactly a return to the global justice movement or the globalization movements, but the ability to readdress those same topics. In other words, the anti-war movements had, and that moment, of course, the urgency of it had focused the energy of activists in various parts of the world strictly on the negative point of the protests of against the war itself. What I think is much more promising, and this is what I hope will develop now, in continuity with many of the things that in the global justice movement, is more, let's say, propositional movements, more movements that can point toward alternatives in the global system. These are the things that seemed to me, before the war began, and especially before 9/11, seemed to me the direction that these globalization movements were going. And I assume that now, with the lesser urgency about protesting the war, it might be a moment when they could be picked up again, and hopefully even picked up at a more advanced moment.
Now, you said something about alternatives, which makes me wonder. The movement had been quite shy about embracing an agenda or program in the traditional left fashion. Do you think that's about to change?
I wouldn't say that. What has seemed, I think, a good place to look in this regard is to what has happened at the various world social forums. First in Brazil in Porto Alegre, and last year in India in Mumbai. It's the world social forums too, and I think this is reflective of the spirit you were just mentioning in the movements, has been very shy to, or even prohibited by the members from pronouncing an agenda. Even I remember it. 2003 meetings in Porto Alegre, the higher-ups organizing the World Social Forum wanted to have a united message against the war. And I doubt that there was a person there in Porto Alegre who wasn't against the war. And yet it was the objection was, we want no pronouncements in our name, no formal agenda of a united front, or we don't want anyone speaking for us. I guess that's a good way of saying it. Nonetheless, there's a lot of propositions of alternatives do enter into the space of these world social forums, even without a united voice, often about very specific issues about water management or about seeds and genetic information or very specific points. It's at that level that there's been a great success so far, at least discussions about alternative systems and alternative arrangements. I recognize the reasons for a resistance in the movements, especially in the U.S., to a unified program. And I think that probably won't change in the near future.
Why the resistance?
I think the resistance, as my understanding of this in general, but of course, anytime it's partly indicative of the same fact that anytime one talks about these various movements in the U.S. or in Europe, they are so many and so varied that it's very difficult to make generalizations. Or once one makes the generalization, someone very rightly challenges you. But I do think that in general, there's a great spirit not just of anti-authoritarianism, which is certainly strong in those movements, but also a recognition of the falsity and even crisis of forms of representation. That the notion that there would be some leadership or even spokesperson that could represent the various people, that it's such forms of representation are seen now, it seems to me, as completely bankrupt and false. And so that recognizing that crisis of generalization leads to sometimes a kind of paralysis, but I think it's an important political recognition of the crisis of such forms of representation, even at the most local level of political organizing. I don't see this as as in itself a necessarily good thing, but I think that also, I think that it has to lead somewhere in order to be a good thing. In other words, I don't think that the movements can go on like this for a significant period, but I think one should also recognize the correctness and the political astuteness in this distrust of representation, and that it could in fact lead somewhere positive, even if in itself it's not necessarily a positive step. Does that make sense when I say it that way?
Yes, I'm not quite sure I'm persuaded, but it makes sense.
No, okay. because it would seem to you that the lack of a program and the lack of being able to take united positions undermines the political effectiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And lack of institutionalization also.
And the lack of institutionalization. I agree with that too. And I myself would like to see more of an ability to be more effective politically in whatever way. I guess all I'm trying to do, and I recognize it's not totally persuasively, is to recognize the validity of the resistance to traditional forms of representation and institutionalization. And I guess therefore what that needs to is the need to invent new ones.
Yeah.
But that's certainly another matter.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly see the point of the critique of these old forums as ossifying and authoritarian, and deadening and all kinds of things, bad things like that. But then I think they have to think new forums, because this kind of formlessness itself just eventually burns out has sharply limited appeal beyond a relatively small group of like-minded sorts.
Right, and even temporally, like you say, it has a limited shelf life sometimes.
Someone asked me to ask you this question, and it's kind of relevant at this point. How do you get to be so optimistic? I know you and Tony Negri come out of this, you know, kind of Italian tradition, which is often, you know, just sees resistance and victory where everyone else sees passivity and defeat. Do you still see great possibilities and the possibilities for great victories ahead?
Yeah, but see, now you've cornered me with the introduction to that question. It's hard for me to answer yes, because it just sounds like, you know, blindly optimistic rather than I don't know how to put this. I mean, let me start from the negative. I mean, there's one way of saying it. Now let me talk in sort of an old tradition thing, which was, you know, for a very long time, the communist tradition was all about defeats. Like that, every even the most glorious victories were defeats. The Paris Commune, 1905 in Russia, you name it. I mean, the insurrection in Shanghai. Everything ended in slaughter. And yet there was a long tradition of recognizing and reading from those horrible defeats a historical narrative of future, not just of future victories, of the ways that the defeats themselves pushed history forward, et cetera. So I think so when Marx writes about that mole, for instance, that is subterranean now and we can't see the political developments, you can imagine someone saying such a thing today. We can't see, you know, 100,000 people in the street of New York today or even in London. And yet the mole, this is Marx's old metaphor, is burrowing underground, making progress, and it will leap up sometime, maybe 10 years from now, and the events will have matured already, and it will have made progress and it'll be forward. I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's a, I don't know if one called it optimism, but a reading of the history of struggles that is deeply ingrained, I think, in the communist tradition that looks at historical development this way. Like when Marx is writing, I don't know, after the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, for instance, things looked horrible. Like, how could he write such an optimistic book? And how could he talk about this as, and I think it's the same sort of question. I'm not making an excuse right now. I guess I'm just trying to situate it in a rather longer tradition. And I'm trying to paint myself, I guess, as very traditionalist in this sense.
It's a strange affinity between the Marxist tradition and Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, I suffered defeat after defeat, yet to victory I am born.
Okay. That's not so bad. I mean, I was also thinking there's a beautiful, and it actually recurs in Jean-Paul Sartre's work, talking about the loser's win phenomenon. In other words, that in fact, what seemed to be a horrible defeat in the long run turns out to have been a victory. And those who seem to be celebrating victory, we soon find were suffering their worst defeat.
Could you hold on a little bit? We have to do a little station business, and I'll be back in about a little under a minute. Could you hold
on?
Okay.
Hi, I'm Ann Hage, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And have we done our business, Michael? Oh, okay. I thought it was a little more complicated than that. I have one more question for the Michael on the phone.
Yeah.
You have a book coming out, a sequel to Empire?
Yes.
Can you say a few words about that? And then we'll have you on to talk about that when it finally emerges.
Oh, great. It's the title is Multitude. It's due out in August from Penguin. And, well, there are really two things to say about it. On the one hand, we think of it as a sequel to the book Empire because, whereas we thought that first book was relatively good, at least to our satisfaction, of describing the contemporary world order, in other words, the structures of domination, what we wanted the second book to do and what we've tried to do in the second book is to talk about the alternatives to it and the possibilities that are emerging today for a more democratic world, possibilities of global democracy, let's say as a shorthand. So that's one difference, that Empire was meant to talk about the structures of domination, and this book, Multitudes, is meant to talk about democratic alternatives. The other difference is I've spent a lot of, I hope, successful effort in trying to write this book for a non-university audience. Empire was really meant to enter into a number of university debates, which actually I think was a nice thing about the book, taking up vocabularies and structures of thought and even internal debates within university questions about post-colonial studies or about deconstructionism, et cetera. This book, on the other hand, I would like as much as possible to have accessible to, of course not, you know, it isn't going to be, I suppose, the general readership that's going to be so involved with such political questions, but at least non-university audiences, readerships, people who are interested in problems of global domination, war, and liberation, let's say. And so I've done my best on that count. I hope successful. But that's the other thing to contrast it with the first book, I suppose.
Okay, well, we all look forward to it, and I'll be in touch and hope to get an interview when the book is out.
You bet.
Thanks for joining us, Michael Hart. Michael Hart joining us by phone from Seattle, where he's spending the summer. He's a professor of literature at Duke University and author, co-author with Tony Negri of Empire and the forthcoming Multitude. And I'll be back in a moment with Julie Abraham after this second word from the Butchies. That was the Butchies, an excerpt from their song 17 from their new album, Make Your Life. Your spelled Y-R. I don't know how to pronounce that exactly. Make Your Life. We're back behind the news. Doug Hammond is my name, WBAI, the station. And we're joined now by Julie Abraham, who teaches LGBT studies at Sarah Lawrence College. And this is our Stonewall segment of the show. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much.
So, I guess, 35 years from Stonewall, this Sunday going into Monday, I guess the movement is sort of reaching its middle age, but in its youth, it was all about challenging the institutions of straight bourgeois society, and now, 35 years later, it's all about getting married. What happened?
Well, in many ways, that's quite a large question. I suppose you could say that the people who set out to challenge the institutions of bourgeois society in the late 1960s and 1970s are not often the same people who are now campaigning for same-sex marriage, much less in many cases the people who are actually getting married. While there were even in the 70s, occasional efforts by same-sex couples to get married. The whole marriage movement didn't really begin until the early 1990s, when people like Andrew Sullivan and other gay conservatives entered the sort of mainstream media and started pushing this alongside their elaboration of the possibility of there being a gay conservative position. I suppose there was a response to their arguments, or even maybe not even to their arguments, but to the promise of sort of social rehabilitation that marriage seems to offer from a lot of queer people who, you know, have come out since the 1960s and 70s and don't sort of see themselves as culturally different or politically committed to whatever it was that gay liberation represented at its inception.
Now, of course, you clearly have some problems with this turn of the movement. What are your reservations about same-sex marriage?
Well, on the one hand, you know, everybody seems so cheerful lining up on the steps of the City Hall in San Francisco. And, you know, and alternatively, people keep saying, well, you know, I need the right to visit my lover in hospital when they're ill. I need to be able to inherit. I need to be able to make medical decisions. So it's sort of hard to object, but I feel like we're being sold a bill of goods in two different directions, that on the one hand, we're sort of living in what is a shrinking public world in which sort of state responsibility for its citizens, the state's responsibility for its citizens is being kind of constantly chipped away at. And in that universe, the kinds of benefits that marriage offers seem more and more valuable. It's like if you're not going to have adequate social security, you desperately need inheritance rights if there's anything to inherit, and so on and so forth. And but to sort of then kind of fight for same-sex marriage on that front is to kind of extend this sort of small pool of benefits that does go to married people to a few more coupled people, rather than sidestepping the broader issue of why don't we have universal health care, why don't we have adequate social security, why don't we have adequate care for people in their old age. So in that, and it's also to kind of collude in this idea that these things are not public responsibility in some sense. And on the other hand, I think, you know, people, maybe because we're sort of living in this shrinking public space, when they want to come out, they kind of can't see where to come out anymore. In a sense, marriage becomes the place to come out. But there again, I think there's a kind of trick involved in that. When you marry, basically what you're coming out into is a universe, is a sort of private institution or a public, an institution that's sort of set up by the state to manage private life. You've kind of made your statement, but you haven't made any, you haven't demanded any extension of the public, of the public sphere, which I think is what people were originally doing when they wanted to come out in the 60s and 70s. They were making a kind of new claim on public life and saying these relationships need to be acknowledged and more forms of relationship need to be acknowledged. It seems to me ironic that in the sort of decades since Stonewall, there has been a kind of flourishing of many different forms of relationships among straight as well as queer people, and that instead of sort of pushing for more forms of recognition for all the forms of relationships that we've been creating and proliferating, to sort of cling to or fight for marriage is to really retreat from those possibilities.
Now, when we spoke this afternoon, you mentioned that this also, we've forgotten the history of marriage in this debate. So could you remind us of some of that history that has been forgotten?
Well, it's sort of extraordinary to me that people talk as if marriage is simply the kind of public recognition of a personal love. If we think about the history of marriage, it's really a history of an institution that was organized for the distribution of property, the distribution of work, and the distribution of stigma. It was an institution founded on inequality, particularly, I mean, obviously for women. This is a very important history. Women were sometimes the property that was exchanged in marriage, but they were rarely the people getting the property being exchanged. They were usually the people doing most of the work. And they were often the recipients of whatever stigma was being distributed around the institution of marriage, so that in the not-too-distant past, it wasn't only queer people who were sort of stigmatized for their sexuality, but single women, divorced women, any woman sort of sexually active outside of marriage. You know, the battles to sort of establish women's right not to marry, women's rights within marriage, the right to own your own property, the right to your own body, the right to make economic choices, the right to divorce, those battles took place over 150 years in this country. And even that, so that it seems to me that now the right, still the right of a woman not to marry is a very sort of fragile and hardly fought right, and to sort of abandon that. And there, I suppose, we come to a point where the sort of history of marriage for men and for women has been very different. But the sort of broader question might be, how do we think about institutions, or how do we think about history? Can institutions be remade? Can we just move into an institution and remake it in our own image? Or does the history of an institution matter, which it seems to me it does? For example, if we think about the history of inequality in marriage, it wasn't only inequality within marriage between men and women, but it was inequality between married people and people who were not married. And one of the ways in which I think the history of inequality continues to manifest itself and will only continue to manifest as same-sex couples get married is to sort of intensify the inequality between the married and the unmarried.
I'm speaking with Julie Abraham, professor of LGBT studies at Sarah Lawrence College. And, well, there are some people who are saying that by allowing same-sex couples to marry, you're sort of queering the institution or revitalizing the institution itself, and it will transform it in some way. What's your response to that kind of argument?
Well, in some sense, it relates back to my previous question of how do institutions change, or to what degree can institutions change? And if we're optimistic about that, then maybe it will revitalize the institution or queer the institution. Although what's striking to me is the number of people who want to get married don't want to get married because they want to queer the institution, but want to get married in the same old institution that always existed. In other words, they want whatever marriage has always meant. So that we can only sort of queer the institution if enough queers go into it with that in mind. If queers are sort of flooding into the institution in order to take advantage of the sort of social status and security and benefits that the institution has always kind of differentially conferred, then the prospect of a real shift is not great. Also, it seems to me that, you know, one of the things that worries me is the sort of parallel decline in the kinds of other institutions that have developed over the last few years in domestic partnership benefits, other forms and structures for recognizing unmarried couples. Are people going to abandon those because they don't have to now? Either you're married or you're not. So that's, you know, will the institution of marriage be queered, and or will the institution of marriage be strengthened because these other kind of lesser forms that have been have sort of been fought for in its vicinity will now all lapse.
Now, a lot of this marriage movement came out of an impulse that said, in a phrase, we're just like everybody else. And in some ways, that's a conservative impulse. On the other hand, it's kind of a radical impulse. I mean, this kind of acceptance of same-sex object choice for the larger society is quite a major transformation insofar as it's happened. So is this a conservative impulse, or is it not as conservative as it might appear in the face?
Well, I suppose in a way we'll only have to see how things play out. The argument that it's radical to demand the kind of social recognition that same-sex marriage implies is a plausible one. Many of the people who are, as I said, marrying, I think, and certainly most of the very vocal campaigners for same-sex marriage, posed marriage as a conservative goal insofar as they posed it as not only a sort of way in which queer people could fully integrate into the normal, into sort of quote-unquote normal society and demonstrate their worthiness, but demonstrate it because they demonstrated their sameness. Insofar as that's what people really are wanting to do, then it does seem a conservative move. On the one hand, I don't want to deny anybody the right to be ordinary, as it were, or the right to certain kinds of social validation. But what I worry about is that the potential for sort of, for example, splitting the group of queer persons into then the good ones and the bad ones, the good gays and the bad gays, and I think that people can kind of get led into this without really even thinking that that's what they're doing. And then you find people saying, well, we're the sort of silent majority of the queer population. We pay taxes, we vote, and we deserve to be married, implying that there's some other group that doesn't deserve to be married or doesn't want to be married and doesn't pay taxes and doesn't vote and are the people who should be bearing the stigma of the group, if that makes sense.
Yeah, a friend of mine a couple of years ago was denounced by Rosie O'Donnell at a social event for, you know, he's one of these bad gays, so he was ruining it for people like her who
Right. Wanted
to be one of the good persons. But this sort of is the paradox of a movement that on one hand wanted to affirm its identity and separateness, at the same time it also wanted to change the larger society. And to some degree, it has changed large society in profound ways and in not so profound ways. You know, men using hair care products, but also changing diapers and doing housework. Women who are now, you know, lawyers and professionals, and it's now normal for women to work. And so there's this, the whole transformation of gender relations over the last 30 years, of which, you know, the gay liberation movement has been an important part. I mean, there's a victory there. So is this kind of like a, you know, historical movement or historical change now that, you know, this transformation of a larger society has been partly accomplished? It's okay to be someone ordinary?
Well, you could say that, you know, it's a real achievement, the right to be ordinary. I mean, on the one hand, I would say that there were a few other forces besides the gay liberation movement that have contributed to all of the social changes that you're pointing to, and feminism and the women's movement might be one that deserves a lot of attention. I would say that while enormous social changes have happened, we can't assume that things move in a sort of single direction. I think things haven't. I think some changes have been made, and we're still sort of in a kind of national cultural universe in which standard conventional images of masculinity and femininity are what get you elected president and first lady, as it were. And so I'm not sure, if we think about the rhetoric of masculinity that's running our current foreign policy, to what degree changes have been made in that arena. I mean, I think in the end, from the very beginning, from before Stonewall, queer politics before Stonewall, long before Stonewall, from the beginning of the 20th century, even the late 19th century, there's been a split between people who wanted to be part of the dominant culture and people who wanted to assert a difference. And that split simply keeps reasserting itself at various crucial moments. It reasserted itself right after Stonewall, and in a sense it's probably about to reassert itself now. And in the end, there's not a sort of right and wrong answer or a unitary movement. There have always been these divisions. And I suppose, ideally, all of us get to move forward voicing our opinions and our visions of what queerness means, and sort of advancing social change however we imagine that to be advanced, without kind of closing off one or the other option.
And you teach at Sorrel Arts College. So what do the students think of all this? Are they looking forward to getting married? Are they nostalgic for the days when Queer Nation was doing kiss-ins?
The students are divided. A lot of them actually, many of them actually looking forward to getting married. Even the students who have the most radical self-presentations. Partly I think that young people today don't know anything about the Queer Nation kiss-ins, unless they're taught, and that what we're seeing is that the history of LGBT politics is not very much taught. And so young people don't know their history, both the sort of history of activism or the history of analysis. I think they're very interested in hearing, for example, about that history or about different sides or different perspectives on the question of marriage. But I think they often feel as if marriage is the way to go, particularly as we're under attack, and it is sort of not hard to see why they feel that. If somebody's telling you you can't do something, there's a certain impulse toward sort of claiming that behavior, that thing. On the other hand, it seems to me a kind of backwards way to organize your political life in a sort of broader sense. Just because somebody doesn't want me to do something does not necessarily mean that that is the thing that I need or want to do. But I think that the students are sort of learning and assessing as they go.
So if you had control of the agenda, what would you be foregrounding rather than marriage at this moment in our political history?
In terms of queer politics?
Yes, yes.
Thank you. You're going to give me a control of that limited part of the agenda. I suppose I would be pressing for analyses of new forms of relationships, new family forms. I would be pressing for education about queer and feminist histories. I would be pressing for much more of an economic and material analysis, a broader kind of racial and class-based queer politics, and politics, you know, a sort of queer politics that sees, for example, universal health care as the issue rather than health care for spouses or the right to be a spouse and therefore the right to get health care, if that makes sense.
That makes lots of sense. And thanks for joining us, Julie Abraham.
Thank you very much for having me.
Maybe we'll have you back to develop that agenda because it's an intriguing one.
Okay.
And that was Julie Abraham, who teaches LGBT studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening, and I'll be back next week. And let's go out with one more from the Butchies, "The Galaxy Is Gay." Sure wish you would have gone here.